Morning, everybody.
Good morning.
So, this morning I would like to talk about the formal side of our practice. Zen, especially Soto Zen that we've inherited from Japan, is a very, very formal style of practice. And there's a power to that, there's a point to that, that I wish to try to bring forth. Let me say on the outset that by speaking of it, I'm not trying to pressure anybody into being more formal than they already are necessarily. That's not why I want to bring it up. So please don't hear anything I say as an admonition to get more serious about your practice. God forbid. But there is a point. There is a meaning. A skillful means. A skillfulness that the very strict formal way actually has to it. And that is what I want to try to point to. But there's also potential difficulty with how formal the practice can be. First, I want to talk about that. Here's a little, this is from Zen Is Right Here. Teaching Stories and Anecdotes of Shunryu Suzuki Roshi. And I said something during Zazen this morning about a student complaining that they couldn't get their mind to quiet down. And Suzuki Roshi responded with, "When your back gets straight, your mind will be quiet." That's also from the same book. And so I invite you to experiment with that. Take that up as a way of study. You know, if you pay careful attention to your posture, to your spine, the chin slightly tucked in, stretching from the top of the head, you know, there's an intimate connection between body and mind. Sometimes we just use one word, body-mind. You know, that's kind of like a Zenism. You know, at Zen Center, people talk about taking good care of our body-mind. You know, just make it one word. And there is a relationship, you know. And so you might notice, okay, when I make an effort to attend carefully to my posture and my breathing, what effect does that have on my conscious awareness? If I notice that I am daydreaming, what's my posture like? You know, Suzuki Roshi admonishes us to tuck our chins in ever so gently. He says, if you don't, if your chin is jutted out, you are probably dreaming, daydreaming. And so, you know, so I said that this morning is kind of like a little experiment, you know. He said that when the back is straight, the mind is quiet. So, you know, check it out and see, you know. See what happens when you're making an effort to settle, to be present, and you're present with your spine, what effect does that have? But that's not the anecdote I wanted to say now. I wanted to speak about the potential snare or trap that might occur with this very formal way. And say, one day, this is the tale. One day, Suzuki Roshi went with a group of us in a truck to a ranch some miles from Tassajara to pick fruit. We were all trying to be good Zen students. Work hard, pick fruit, pack boxes. Work hard, pick fruit, pack boxes. We didn't realize how serious we had become until Suzuki Roshi climbed a tree and started throwing fruit at us. So he was probably having a good time. He loved his sincere Zen students. But he also probably saw that they were a little attached to being good Zen students and wanted to shake them up a little bit. And so let me get my notes out in case there's something of value there. So that's the one thing, you know, with a highly formal way where we have a, where we do things just so. You know, in temple life, in Zen center, and you know, gassho is just like this. You know, the hands are together, fingers are together. They're not splayed apart, but they're together. There's no hat rack with a thumb that should be up here too. And they're about 6 inches from the nose. And the arms aren't tight next to the body, but there's energy there. It's a mudra. So you know, see, some people do it like this. You know, at Eheiji, they can get really uptight. But we say, you know, it should be, you know, there's energy there. It's not, you know. And, you know, you put yourself out. You come out of the closet and into gassho, you know. And you really, you know, there's a certain dharma boldness about it. Yes, I am doing this. Yeah. And so, when things, and the mudra, you know, the fingers are on top of one another, the middle joints of the middle fingers touch, the thumb tips touch ever so lightly. And it's a nice round open oval. It's not kind of like this. It's not the hands collapsing into the lap, but there's energy there. The arms are slightly away from the body. And just so, the thumb tips lightly touching, taking good meticulous care of the mudra. The thing about it is very, very easy to get caught in notions of good and bad, right and wrong. I'm not doing it right. I'm not doing it well. And, you know, Green Gulch is in Sesshin right now. I'm a kitchen monk doing sesshins, and this happens to be my day off, so it was very, you know, easy for me to come. And, you know, I'm transparent with Zen Center about when I do leave the practice there. In the kitchen practice, you know, there's very precise ways of doing things. Very specific ways of doing things. You know, we practice silently, especially during sesshin. When we do the dishes, when we put away the bowls, we try to do so with mindfulness and attentiveness and quietly, so that, you know, we make minimum amount of noise when we put the bowl back in, or when we're washing it and lifting a heavy pot. You know, just not letting it clang in the sink, but trying to minimize how much noise we make. If we're making rice, you know, and we regard the rice as our eyeballs. So we got a bowl full of washed rice and we're emptying it into the pot. And we got a spatula. We're working hard to get just about every single grain of rice into the pot. Very easy to fall into the notion of this, you know, I've got to be a good Zen student. You know, and then if I don't make sure to get every single grain of rice, I'm a bad Zen student. Or to fall into the other extreme and see how, oh, this is so uptight. You know, these people are really anal. and then kind of like be dismissive of the form, the formality. And become a card-carrying iconoclast and poke fun at it and try to sabotage it by whispering inane songs into the people who are about to go into the zendo of the sesshin, so it'll run through their heads while they're sitting. See, all this stuff is, you know, we not having yet stepped through the gate of what these strict rules are supposed to help us with. I have in my notes that I was going to do a little bit of autobiography here. When I first encountered this practice in 1991 in Tassajara, I was deeply, deeply moved. I saw people bowing to each other and the chant before lunch. And I felt the power of the practice. And, you know, Suzuki Roshi said that big mind is with everything that you see. Big mind is everything. And, you know, it is with what you see. And so I would be walking up and down Tassajara, earnestly practicing being present, seeing the way the light was dancing on the water, and feeling great joy. I've seen, you know, the nature of mind, seeing a true being. And then I started to feel, then I started noticing, I'd get feedback by not doing things correctly. And then I became one of those iconoclasts. You know, a few years down the road, I was one of the ones who would poke fun at how uptight all these Zen students were. And I've been reflecting on that time. And I may have mentioned something like this last month or recently, that the person who felt compelled to mock the seriousness of uptight Zen students was the person who didn't quite feel worthy to practice the way. And so since I didn't feel like I'd ever really gain entry, I would poke fun of those people who were trying earnestly to gain entry. So my sincerity was entangled with my self-doubt and my mocking. I wasn't terrible at it, but every once in a while I would mock the tight formalism of some of the students. And now I see, quote-unquote, uptight Zen students differently than I did 15 years ago. I see people who are feeling, if I try real, real hard, if I really, really give it my all and work hard, maybe someday I'll be worthy of the Dharma. And they're burning themselves up, creating a fever in their heart and mind because they also don't quite feel worthy yet. But they have some measure of hope that they can make themselves worthy. Yet another example of sincerity that's kind of crippled a little bit or is caught and isn't flowing freely yet. So that's a little snippet autobiographically of my relationship to our formal way. But what is the point? Why all the fuss and bother? Simply put, this comes from Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind. And I actually wrote it down, so let's read it. Did I write it down or do I have to look it up in the book? Hang on a second. So think about this. When we express our true nature, we are human beings. When we do not know what we are. We are not an animal because we walk on two legs. We are something different from an animal, but what? We may be a ghost. We do not know what to call ourselves. Such a creature does not actually exist. It is a delusion. We are not human being anymore. But we do exist. When Zen is not Zen, nothing exists. Intellectually, my talk makes no sense. But if you have experienced true practice, you will understand what I mean. If something exists, it has its own true nature. It's Buddha nature. So, being human is not a given, is what he's saying right there. being human is something that needs to be practiced. And I hasten to say, not necessarily Soto Zen practice, but to remain human, to resume and continue our humanity, takes intentionality. We cannot assume that our true human nature is coming forth because we have this form. I thought about this passage from Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind, when I heard the news from Fort Hood, where yet again someone among us abandoned the effort to remain human and became some other kind of being. I don't know what to call a ghost, a suffering, tormented demon. I don't know what to call that, but I think that illustrates that being human is not something that we can assume. I don't mean to imply that that person is an inhuman monster. That's not my point. My point is that his humanity had no way, had lost its way out into truth, into reality. So, for us to be human, our inmost nature must have some way, some medium to express and realize itself. And our inmost nature desires some medium, some way to express and realize itself. And we answer this inmost request through our forms of practice, is what Suzuki Roshi says. And how does that work? How does that happen? What is the pivot that happens? And then how do we enter into that dynamic pivot where our true nature can express and realize itself? We can feel the freedom that this practice offers. This practice offers a certain fundamental freedom where we can, with composure, with calm, with some measure of peace, be ourselves in this world. That's what we long for, and it's a legitimate longing. Longing for peace is maybe the one legitimate longing that you don't have to be too wary of. And so how? Well, here's a story about Dongshan. Dongshan is one of the founders of the Soto Zen school. So Dongshan was about to leave his teacher, and Yun Yan, I think. I'm sorry, I didn't write it down here. And in his mind, apparently, he was somewhat distracted, according to the record. And his teacher admonished him, you know, if you're going to propagate the great way, don't be careless. Okay, sorry. And so he went on his way, and he was crossing a bridge. And as he was crossing the bridge, he looked down and saw his reflection. And upon seeing his reflection, he had a realization. He understood something. And he wrote a poem about what he saw when he saw his reflection in the river crossing the bridge. And the poem goes as follows. Just don't seek from others, or you will be far estranged from yourself. I now go on alone. Everywhere I go, I meet him. There's some translations. Everywhere I go, I meet it. He is now me. I now am not him. Or It now is me. I now am not it. One must understand in this way to realize suchness. So that's his expression. And that line, I talked about a pivot, how there's a way in which we can engage a practice that allows us to enter a dynamic pivot where our true nature can express and realize itself. Well, that pivot is expressed in this line, he now is me, I now am not him. Or it now is me, I now am not it. And this pivot is reflected also in the Sangottai, where it says, you are not it, it actually is you. Same point. And one must understand what that means to realize suchness. One must understand in this way so that we can freely, with ease, express and realize our human heart, and we can flow freely. So, let's try to unpack this a little bit with the help of Suzuki Roshi. This morning, this is from a lecture he gave, I said, you must find yourself in each being. You must find yourself in each being. This is actually what Tozan Zenji, that's Dongshan in Japanese, said. Don't try to seek yourself. Do not try to find yourself. Don't go seeking yourself. Don't use practice trying to find yourself. Who am I? You know. Don't seek yourself. Don't try to figure out who is you. You, quote unquote you, found out in that way is far from the real you. He is not you. He's not any more you. So if you sit down, or if you engage in some practice looking for something, who am I really? What is my life? What is this practice? If you're seeking something, you're creating a false you. And then whatever you find will not be you. He is not any more you. But if I go my own way, wherever I go, I see myself. You know, if you take your own step, it's the Bodhisattva way. Wherever you go, you will see yourself. You will meet with yourself. And he says, the image you see in the water when you want to find out who is you is not you. But actually, just what you see in the water is you. You yourself. So the way we make effort is joyful self-abandonment. We do gassho, and once again, I'm not trying to admonish you to do it a certain way, but to illustrate the point, we do gassho in a certain way to forget ourselves. And the efficacy of the highly formal way is the more precise we do it, the more energy we bring to giving all of ourselves into the doing of it, the freer we are. The more completely we give ourselves to just sitting, just holding the mudra with great care, and taking care of our posture with great care, and attending to the breath, expecting nothing at all, but just giving ourselves so fully to the mudra, to the breath, to the posture, that there's nothing left over we hear ourselves in the birds. We feel ourselves in the air entering our lungs. Our true being that is in no way contrived, no way anticipated. We meet moment after moment after moment in each being, everywhere we go, we see ourselves. We're not projecting ourselves onto stuff to make a self for ourselves, but our true life comes forth as the way the water is washing the bowl and the light is playing on the surface as we're washing the bowl, as the sounds of our environment. Are passing on the street. If we seek some realization, then all that is covered over with small self. You are not it. But when we forget ourselves, when we fully give ourselves to each and every little thing of our life without greed, without longing, then we are the dance of the wind and the red leaves out there. We're not separate from that. But if we seek to unite with that, we're far estranged from that. That's the pivot. I am not that tree out there dancing in the wind. If I seek to unite with it, I'm far estranged from myself. If I forget all about that, that I can receive half freely. So there's a lecture of Suzuki Roshi's. In the Lotus Sutra, there's one chapter in which Buddha is talking about our rules. Why we observe our practice is just to help ourselves keep our practice and make it easy to help ourselves. So the point in this section is that a very strict, formal way, and I'm not trying to preach formalism, but I'm trying to illustrate the point, a very strict, formal way makes it easier for us to be ourselves. A very strict formal way makes it easier for us to get some realization of our true nature. And realization is not quite the same thing as experience. But realization of our true nature will have an effect that will color our experience moment by moment. But it is not the same thing as our moment by moment experience. But something about a highly formal way can make it easier for us to have some realization of our true human nature. And that's what he's getting at here. It's easy to help ourselves. It is, you know, an easy practice. You may think to follow rigid rules is difficult practice. Someone said, oh, I wish I didn't start with this, you know, kind of difficult Zen religion. And then he says here that he laughs, as if Hiroshi laughs when he says that too. Maybe we feel in that way, but if you know what is real practice, you know then various precepts and rules of Buddhist way will help us. And we will find it easy to follow Bodhisattva way because of the rules set up by Buddha. You need one small room for yourself. That is very true. And when you find yourself, really, in the small room, as one with the small room, then there's you yourself. And the whole universe is there. And the whole universe makes sense to you. Without the room, the whole universe doesn't make any sense. So what you need now is the small room. That is actual reality, which is always true with everyone. So don't talk about whole universe or some mysterious experience, but to find yourself in the small room or in the rigid practice of Zen. You shouldn't go that way. You should go this way. You should cross your legs this way. Or as I just said, Gassho is just like this. Very, very small room. It's not like this. It's not like this. It's not over here. It's just like this. Very, very small room. Under this kind of limitation, you will find yourself. Real self is there. But because you say, you discuss whether this room is good, bad, big, or small, you lose your real room. But the point, that's the danger, of getting attached to being a good Zen student, doing it correctly. It's not about doing it correctly. It's about finding some small room that allows you enough orientation to open up to the limitlessness of who we actually are. It's not about right or wrong, good or bad, although it can easily appear that way. So, before you discuss, before you're caught by discrimination or thinking mind, you own your room. So, earnestly avoid seeking outside yourself. This is, you own the care with which you hold your mudra. It's coming from you. It's not being imposed from the outside. It will not work if it's imposed from the outside. It will only work when you own your own room, where you joyfully give yourself away into the practice. So that's the basic, whether you become a really enthusiastic person towards formal Zen or not doesn't matter so much. Whether you say, I'm going to shave my head and be a priest or stay a layman doesn't matter so much. There's an underlying theme in Suzuki Roshi's presentation of how to practice, and he uses the phrase forget yourself quite a lot. He says, of course, we must make a big effort, but we must forget ourselves in the effort that we make. He says that when we, in Zazen we follow our breathing, but the way to follow your breathing is to forget about yourself and just sit and feel your breathing. So the underlying theme is faith. Faith that the practice is worthy of our whole being. Another way to say that is faith that this moment of our life deserves our entire life, the context of this very moment, deserves our all. Now, we can understand that intellectually. I can hear some vocalizations of assent. The formal way gives us a little room by which to enact this attitude. We can give ourselves fully to this. It's safe. It's not going to hurt us to abandon ourselves to just this, or just this. Or, like with Pam, when I was rehearsing with her, that, we'll bow to each other first, I'll take the things and bow. When we have that really clear, specific way, then there's this channel opened up where our true nature has a chance to express and realize itself. So that's the meaning behind the forms. And that's the heart of the practice, is to find a way that you can actually fully give yourself away, moment after moment after moment, and gratefully receive your actual being in each and every thing that you meet, moment after moment after moment. That's the pivot. You are not it. You can't go find yourself. Give it up. Don't look for yourself. You're nowhere to be found. But you're right here. You're a car going across the road there. The songs of birds. You can meet yourself in each and every being if you stop looking for yourself. I'll close with a reading from Zen Mind Beginner's Mind that I've already referenced a lot, but I want to read it in its entirety. Not the whole book. One section of the book. Not even the whole section, a piece of a section. The only way to study pure mind is to practice. Our inmost nature wants some medium, some way to express and realize itself. We long to become human. We want to find a way to be fully human. We need some way to be human, or we'll end up being ghosts. It's my little parenthetical insert there. We answer this inmost request through our rules. And patriarch after patriarch shows us his true mind. In this way, we will have an accurate, deep understanding of practice. At least we must have some enlightenment experience. You must put confidence in the big mind, which is always with you. You should be able to appreciate things as an expression of big mind. This is more than faith. This is ultimate truth which you cannot reject. Whether it is easy or difficult to practice, easy or difficult to understand, you can only practice it. Priest or layman is not the point. To find yourself as someone who is doing something is the point. To resume your actual being through practice. To resume, notice the word resume, to take up again the you which is always with everything, with Buddha, which is fully supported by everything. Right now. You may say it's impossible, but it is possible. Even in one moment, you can do it. It is possible this moment. It is this moment. That you can do it in this moment means you can always do it. So if you have this confidence, this is your enlightenment experience. If you have this strong confidence in your big mind, you are already a Buddhist in the true sense, even though you did not attain enlightenment. And so we need a way to be human. I hasten to say again that Soto Zen Buddhism is not the only way, I feel. I've met great human beings who were Christians, Jews, practitioners of other non-religions, but we need a way to hear that bird, to hear that bird in emptiness, so that we can meet ourselves and know some peace. Any questions? Larry.
Yeah, I would just... you reminded me that when I first... I think it was my first session... I worked in the kitchen too, and I was constantly making jokes and comments. You know. And I actually got reported at one time by somebody who said I was disturbing her Zen practice. And one of the leaders came and told me that. And and I still kept doing it, you know. I mean, I had that same attitude of thinking, oh, these forms are so, you know. Mm-hmm. In fact, I wrote about, at first to Shin, I wrote about meal forms, which I thought were absolutely preposterous and horrible. But at a certain point, something shifted, and I'm not sure exactly when it was, but all of a sudden, being meticulous, this was Joko Beck's work, she does it all the time, being meticulous about practice, became, it just became natural, it became what I couldn't even imagine not doing it. Some sessions, I was actually the session director, and so I was watching for everything. And you can see people who are resisting simply by the way they stand, by the way they walk. You can see it. And what's remarkable, and to me, was that over the course of the session, you could sort of see the zendo sort of straighten up. Mm-hmm. It becomes, the lines become straight, and everybody becomes involved and committed to what's happening. So it's always been sort of remarkable to me that happens, and then it happens to me. It's now just what I accept, what I sort of do. You know? Mm-hmm. So, the forms are. I think Katagiri Roshi said something about once he said, what we do is ridiculous. Zen practice is ridiculous. If you sit there and think about what we're doing, it's totally ridiculous, but it's also the way. Mm-hmm. And I think both of those are true.
There's something about when there is that, when the awkwardness and the resistance drops away in a sesshin, then all of a sudden there's a deepening of stillness that happens, and it's palpable, you know. And stillness is initially not so comfortable. You know, it's like because there's a clarity that comes with stillness, and we see things that maybe we've been strategizing unconsciously to avoid seeing. You know, just our own skin, being comfortable in our own skin is something that we're usually not so skilled at. But when sesshin kind of like compels us to get in touch with ourselves, because you know there's no place to hide, and eventually that turns, you know, that that's something that we're railing against and fighting, but you know, eventually we give up, and then there can be such peace.
Yes. This is just trying to here. There's a little kitchen story at one of the Green Gulch sessions, John Rock, is his last name, and I were assigned to the kitchen duty, and we had lasagna that night, and there's a lot of people there. And John and I were assigned to the lasagna pans, and it was very intensely cheese burned stuck on the pans. And we understood it was silence. So we were going through the big pan, and I was trying to scrape off the cheese, and he had the hot water going, but we had talk a little bit, but we're trying not to, because it was your only way to get up, and then the sink would fill with this cheese and debris, and we'd have to just like throw it in the garbage. It was so messy, and then just one after the next pan was coming in, and finally we thought we were done, and we just, big sigh of relief. And we were, it was getting late in terms of getting back to Sashin, and we just like looked at each other, and we're just like, oh. And someone walked in with another huge pan, and we just looked at each other, and we practically we were laughing. We could not stop laughing, and people were looking at us like, what is wrong with them? We were laughing so hard, we were actually had tears coming down our face, and we finally got that done, and we just were. I mean, it was, we could not stay within the form. The form sort of had to become different because of the circumstances. But anyway, it was memorable. Mm-hmm. You know, I just had to share it with that. Thank you.
I'm just thinking of that thing about being human as expressing ourself or something, but isn't part of being human not being human? I mean, so much of my years or time has been not being human, and then now I have more glimpses of being human, and then I can see when other people are not human, even just in a little interaction where they're not.
Yeah.
They're on TV.
Or something.
Yeah. Well, yeah, we, you know, I think we need to be careful that we don't disparage living beings. You know? That's the, you know, I think there's a point to what Suzuki Roshi is saying that I'm using. But also, you know, there's a saying that from the perspective of a Buddha, there's no difference between sentient beings and Buddhas. From the perspective of a sentient being, there's a big difference, you know. And I think something analogous is true here. I mean, from the heart of compassion, all beings are human. And some human beings are suffering from under the delusion that they're not human, but they're still human. If I understand the point of your question, is that, you know, that we're human when we're not human, because there's still something within us that is yearning to be free, and we don't want to disparage that. Is that kind of like what you're thinking?
Yeah, it's in that whole realm. Yeah.
But there's a reality. So that's why I like that analogy between, you know, they say that, you know, from the perspective of Buddhas, there's no difference between a Buddha and sentient being, but from the perspective of a sentient being, there's a big difference between samsara and nirvana, you know. And so the person is still human, even if they haven't found that medium, that way to express and realize their humanity. It's still there, longing for expression. And the pressure of not being able to express it, being blocked, can be have horrendous results. You know, I think back to, you know, when Columbine happened, and people were saying, they're monsters, that's inhuman, how could they ever do that? I understood. I was bullied a lot in junior high school and elementary school. And in young adulthood, I would wake up from dreams of taking a shotgun and just firing into a crowd of people. I'd wake up horrified that my mind could produce such a thing, and I would quickly try to get something else in there. So, you know, the consequences of being able to express your humanity, of not being able to, of having that blocked, can result in monstrous acts. But the monstrous acts are a result of a human heart that hasn't been able to blossom. Not that there's no humanity, but the humanity has been oppressed or wounded or blocked somehow. So does that relate to what you're trying to say?
Yeah. I just have to say something. It's trivial, but I resist so much formal things, and I just went to the dentist, and I have to brush my teeth 3 times a day, and I just thought, this really helped me. I'm not kidding. I mean, truly.
Yeah. So you can brush your teeth just to brush your teeth, not to get them clean. They'll get clean.
Yeah, no.
You can do both. Yeah. Make sure to do both. The way, you know. Closing chant, top of page 4.
I vow to become it.